Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Charting Queer Health, a podcast at the intersection of queer culture, healthcare, and research. On behalf of Howard Brown Health in Chicago, I'm your host, Matt. I am a cis white gay man, a Chicago resident, but most importantly, I have the incredible opportunity to sit down with various experts across our organization and across our community to learn from their expertise, amplify their stories and voices, and advance the conversation surrounding queer healthcare. Here at Howard Brown Health, we're always trying to advance the conversation surrounding healthcare in as many different areas as we can: social posts, flyers, newsletters, emails, the podcast. So sometimes we have a little bit longer of a break than we intended, but we're back. And I'm so excited about this episode. Joining us today is Dr. Francesco Tanni. He is dual boarded in family medicine and addiction medicine at Howard Brown Health. He is a primary care physician and an HIV specialist. He also works at West Suburban Medical Center, where he is the assistant service chief of addiction medicine. And he's also an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Rush University. There, he is core faculty of the addiction medicine fellowship as well. Doctor, thank you so much for coming. This is our first episode back in a while. So you're kind of the inaugural guest of part two of the podcast here. So thank you for making time.
Thank you.
You, I think, actually reached out to me initially. Mm-hmm. We were talking about something else related, and you said, can we talk about alcohol use, mm-hmm. or alcohol use disorder? And it piqued my interest, and here we are. So I was explaining to you earlier, this is kind of a free form little session we have. So I've got a list of questions. We'll run over them. But I just can't wait to dive into alcohol use disorder. So the first question that I usually bring up in podcasts is regarding language and vocabulary. So is there a difference between alcoholism, alcohol use disorder, alcohol use in general? How do we talk about this as from a healthcare standpoint or from just a cultural standpoint, and what differences do those kind of terms make?
Yeah. So in addiction medicine, we're very careful about the language we use because these are often very stigmatized diagnoses. And language is like constantly evolving and changing. So the current way that we, the current kind of verbiage that we use for people who are struggling with kind of pathologic drinking or really with is alcohol use disorder. So that's the term that is in the DSM, and that's the actual like diagnostic name, alcohol use disorder. It used to be called alcoholism. That's like an older term that has basically fallen out of favor and is replaced with alcohol use disorder. So alcohol use disorder is like today what was previously called alcoholism. Probably the other term that is we really try to avoid is alcohol abuse. So, you know, especially when I talk to like residents or medical students that I work with, you know, I always tell them, you know, you can abuse, you know, people, you can abuse animals, but you can't really abuse substances or like a bottle of liquor. So when we're talking about drinking, we could talk about like alcohol misuse or alcohol use disorder or risky drinking. But we try to avoid the terms alcoholism or abuse.
Yeah, that makes sense. It tracks that abuse is more of a personal descriptor as it involves like people or like other living beings, but you can't abuse an object or a substance necessarily.
And it's a very moralized term. You know, it has a lot of moral implications, the term abuse.
So. Yeah, yeah.
And alcohol use disorder is a disease ultimately. So it's not an issue of like abuse.
Yeah. I always ask that question to start out because it really does frame the whole podcast when we think about, you know, alcohol use disorder as a disease versus like, obviously, the moralized take that culture has on alcohol use. Weirdly moralized and like non-moralized in that it's normalized kind of, or using alcohol in a moderate fashion. We'll dive into all of that. But I just, I think it's fascinating to get the language take on it. So alcohol use disorder, how the first question that jumps into my mind is how do you classify that versus just a moderate or, you know, high level consumption of alcohol?
Yeah.
Is there a difference? Where is that line?
Yeah. So I do get this question a lot also in clinic from patients all the time or patients' family members. So basically, Well, first of all, full disclosure, I do drink alcohol. I have been going to, you know, gay bars since in my whole adult life. I love going to Roscoe's. I live right next to Roscoe's and Sidetrax and, you know, Club Berlin, rest in peace.
I'll probably see you at Roscoe's or Sidetrax in the future.
I've been around alcohol and I've consumed alcohol for a long time. So basically, and it's such a big part of like many cultures, especially amongst the LGBTQ population. But alcohol use can basically be, is a spectrum. So this has been, you know, studied and characterized by the NIAAA, which is the National Institutes of Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse. Lots of stigmatizing terms in that name of that federal agency, but...
sometimes federal agencies are a little bit slow to keep up with the time, so we'll give them a pass this one.
Yeah, so the NIAAA, they kind of help us categorize drinking. So, you know, it's a spectrum. We can divide things into low-risk drinking, high-risk drinking, and then alcohol use disorder. So low-risk drinking is really defined, and I need to actually preface this by saying an unfortunate truth, which is something that just is true and sucks, that alcohol is ultimately a poison. It's like a toxic substance. There's just no way around it. I really wish that wasn't true, but it is. So for many, many people, large parts of the population, really no amount of drinking is safe, especially people with like liver disease or patients who are pregnant. But let's just say in general, low-risk drinking could be defined as, or what the NIAAA defines it as, two or less drinks for a man in any sitting or one or less drink for a woman. These are, obviously at Howard Brown, we work with like a very gender diverse population, and these are like highly gendered you know, recommendations that come from the government. Yeah. So we kind of have to like navigate that sometimes, but low risk drinking is two or less drinks for a male in a setting or one or less drink for a woman. And then in a week, 14 or less for men and 7 or less for women. And then high risk drinking, they define as 5 or more drinks in a sitting for a male and 4 or more drinks for a female. And then IAAA also defines a binge drinking episode as 5 or more drinks. Another way that you can categorize high risk drinking, because, you know, people are like, well, I don't drink every day. Maybe I just drink when I go out on the weekend. So 5 or more episodes of quote unquote binge drinking in a month. So you can imagine if you go out Saturday and Sunday and you're drinking heavily, you would fall into the category of high risk drinking, according to the NIAAA. And then after that, there's actual the proper alcohol use disorder. So that's really a psychiatric illness, and it's a pattern of pathological behaviors that people have in their relationship with alcohol.
Okay. That is really fascinating to me. Just because, especially when you get into like the binge territory, I won't get too personal, but I have a lot of friends who regularly hit that benchmark. And it's not ever, they don't ever discuss it in that way as like binge.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, you went out both nights that weekend, all 4 weekends of the month. And so it's kind of fascinating. I mean, I knew, and they probably know that it would be classified that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody, when they go to their, you know, primary care provider has the little survey of like, do you drink? How often would you say? And I think that's one of those, like, probably not the most accurate numbers.
Yeah,
because people are, you know, for a lot of reasons that we've talked about in other episodes, people are either people pleasers or they want to give the right answer to their provider or whatever it is. So they kind of gloss over it. Or
they're afraid, you know, people are really nervous about judgment that they might get from their primary care provider. That's something that at Howard Brown, we talk about a lot amongst providers. So, you know, it's hard, right? If your doctor's asking you how much you're drinking, you can feel like, oh gosh, what are they going to say? If I tell them how much I'm drinking, am I going to get in trouble in some way? Or some people are just also, all of us at times are in denial. I mean, when I first saw these numbers in medical school, I was shocked. I was like, wow, these are not, it does not take much to enter the high-risk drinking category. Again, I want to separate that from alcohol use disorder. So that's high-risk drinking. So, you know, that's drinking at a level that is known to cause physiologic problems, but it's not the same as alcohol use disorder.
Yeah. And I feel like the struggle I've always had with thinking about alcohol use in general is that so much of it feels like a circumstance of lifestyle, and it very, at least in my experience for me, very rarely is it like I need this type of dynamic, and that's how it's always portrayed as like an addiction in the media, and I've, you know, for myself and for a lot of people, there's no like addiction necessarily, but you do use it a lot. So what is the choice to classify it in terms of just amount drank deliberate to kind of counteract that like justification people might have of like, oh, like it's, I just work in nightclubs and that's why I happen to drink a lot. And you know, it's not an addiction. It's just coincidence or like that kind of framing is interesting to me. So how do you think about, you know, people that say that kind of try to factor environment and lifestyle and stuff into it? Or
yeah, I mean, those things are all very important, right? Our circumstances like greatly will determine like our relationship with various substances, including alcohol. And I think for a lot of my friends, people I know, especially LGBTQ people, if we're, especially on times that we're drinking a lot, myself included, it's often because we're in those settings, right? We're in bars, we're in nightclubs. It's used as a social lubricant because, you know, we're often, especially if you think about like, I've thought about this a lot about like why as in the like kind of queer population, why do I see so much drinking? And one thing I was thinking is, well, we come from such diverse backgrounds and we share an identity, right? But we're coming from like such diverse backgrounds, like ethnic, cultural, religious, many people have a lot of trauma. There's a lot of people estranged from their families. Like a lot of my patients in clinic have that issue. And so to bring all these people together, it doesn't surprise me that we come together in a place where there's a intoxicant that's also a social lubricant to like basically help people feel more at ease. So I think I think the circumstances are a big thing. I think another important thing is that one thing I like about these criteria and this guidance coming from the NIAAA is that, you know, and also why I'm glad that alcoholism has been replaced with alcohol use disorder is what this all recognizes is that our relationship with alcohol is really a spectrum. It's not a black and white situation. So people can, you know, there's like, yeah, low risk drinking, high risk drinking, there's alcohol use disorder. Alcohol use disorder itself can be further categorized as like mild, moderate, or severe. And so it's all pointing to the fact that we have a spectrum that we can move up and down in. And, you know, what isn't a problem at one point can quickly become one. You know, I saw that a lot during the pandemic. People's drinking became more severe, more ultimately like more pathologic. And a lot of it was just coping, you know, with the pandemic. So I think the nice thing about this whole thing is that it creates like a spectrum that we can help place people in and further stratify also like their risk and what we should do about it, rather than it being a black and white, oh, I don't have a problem or I do have a problem. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. You can't sort it out that quickly. It was something that a lot of times has emotions or like, behavioral things tied to it. It's, you can't, you know, just parse it into yes or no. There is a spectrum. So that's, it makes sense that it's phrased that way. It's interesting to think about like that number, whatever number of drinks, if it's, you know, 10 over the course of a weekend is pretty standard for somebody my age per se, but if you ask my dad, who's, you know, 70, he'd be like, oh, that's a lot. So there's a lot of other dynamics that factor into, well, actually that's a question. So if somebody who's 24 presented with the same the high number of drinks that somebody who is 70 did, and you know, the person who's 70 is probably drinking alone, you know, mm-hmm. in their man cave every night of the week, but one or two every night, versus like somebody who's 24 is like really going hard over the weekend. But it's, you know, just 'cause they're being social. Like, do you look at those any differently? 'Cause I feel like society does, but it's, you know, on paper, they might be drinking the same amount every week. So it's,
that's an interesting question. So the NIAAA, it doesn't actually stratify people in that way. It does, mm-hmm. you know, differentiate between men and women, as I mentioned, but really ultimately for me, when I'm talking to a patient about their alcohol use, usually by the time I'm seeing someone, especially if I'm using my addiction medicine hat, I'm really diving into kind of their psychological relationship with alcohol or really any other substance. So, you know, in age, I think for us, kind of like how you were saying it, I found that really interesting. You're like, oh, well, a 24-year-old is going on the weekends and they're just socializing. But, you know, if you're drinking 10 drinks in an evening, that's a lot. I mean, it's just the reality of the situation. That is definitely harmful. And, you know, that's okay. It's okay that people do that as long as they're aware that that is right. known to be harmful. That's what right. I tell patients.
Harm reduction is a big recurring theme here on the podcast. We've talked about it in a few different episodes. So longtime viewer or listeners should be, you know, aware of the fact that like we can call something harmful while still not shaming mm-hmm. you for using it.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're still going to do our best to make sure that we're going to allow you to live the life that you're probably going to live with while reducing as many of the negative side effects of it as we can. So, to clarify that, but, sorry, I probably interrupted you. Keep going.
No, it's okay. And I mean, I think that's a great point that shame is not very helpful. I see a lot of, especially the family members of patients with substance use disorders of various kinds, you know, and or their friends or, you know, their colleagues. We often try to use shame, you know, to try to like change people's behaviors. But shame is not actually a very helpful emotion for people to have. And in fact, it can really exacerbate, various psychiatric conditions, but including substance use disorders. So, but I think that people should still be aware. You know, I think even in the harm reduction space, it's people should be informed of, you know, the data that we have and what the science is telling us. And even if it's like a hard pill to swallow, you know, which with the alcohol, these like alcohol numbers, it is even for me, you know, to think, mm-hmm. okay, this is like, you know, if I go out and I'm drinking with people on the weekend and I'm at some event, you know, and I'm drinking more, I do have in my mind, I'm like, okay, this is harmful at this mm-hmm. point. This is like harmful drinking. Mm-hmm. So people should know that we shouldn't, how can I say this? Like soften it too much or
normalize or glamorize. I mean, yeah, if you think about drinking culturally and the amount of songs, the amount of, you know, it's very, I'll dive into that in a second because I have a lot of cultural related questions, but I do want to dive into the actual medical results and symptoms of alcohol use disorder. So to be clear, a diagnosis of this is just based off of the self-reporting of how many drinks you have in a weekend or a sitting. There's not like a test you can do for this. It's not anything like that. It's just self-identification.
Yeah, that's a good question. So what's so interesting and is like, I'm always like, when I talk to medical students about this especially, it's like, it's just a really interesting fact for many people, is that the actual diagnosis of alcohol use disorder is not at all dependent on how much you're drinking, which is kind of strange. So low risk drinking we talked about, and high risk drinking, mm-hmm. and those are separate from alcohol use disorder. And alcohol use disorder is, as I mentioned, a psychiatric illness, and it's the criteria for it are in the DSM, and there's 11 criteria. And these 11 criteria fall into three broad categories, and none of them have to do with exactly how much you're drinking. So it's not like I'm drinking X amount, mm-hmm. oh, you have alcohol use disorder, mild, moderate, or severe. Criteria for alcohol use disorder, kind of the three broad categories, are loss of control in drinking. So that would be like having a lot of cravings or drinking more than intended, right? So you're losing control over your own consumption of alcohol. The other main aspect is the disruption of a patient's psychosocial life. So that would be like when alcohol begins to interfere with a patient's work or life. And the last one is the formation of dependence. So that would be tolerance or withdrawal. So tolerance is, oh, I need more. I need to drink more to get the same effect as I previously did. And withdrawal, which is a syndrome that happens once you stop drinking and you essentially feel sick. So those three kind of categories, so loss of control, disruption of psychosocial life, and dependence, those things together give us a picture of a person's relationship with alcohol, and that is where the diagnosis comes from.
Gotcha. So it's not, I mean, you could check all of the boxes and only be drinking, I guess, hypothetically, twice, you know, two drinks a week.
Yeah.
And still check all the boxes, and you would still technically be diagnosed as alcohol use disorder, but it's not about volume. That is interesting.
Isn't that shocking? Yeah. I feel like it was shocking to me when I first kind of dove into this. I was like, that is so interesting.
It's like validating in a way, because the first part we were talking about, like, oh, everybody's hitting these numbers, that's a lot. But then when you think about, you know, all the psychosocial stuff that goes along with it, it's not, you know, a black and white number. There's a lot of other dynamics. So I think that's really fascinating. There's no genetic like predisposition for, you know, addiction or dependence on alcohol, or is there, you know, any trends you see with demographics that this is more heavily affects or anything as far as that's concerned?
Yeah, there is. There are basically risk factors for the development of alcohol use disorder. And there almost certainly is a genetic component, although that's a science that's constantly in flux. But there are even twin studies. That's probably some of the stuff that gives us the most interesting insight for. And in twin studies, what people have shown is that probably
twin studies meaning on like fraternal.
Yes, like twins that, and then basically, if one of one person has alcohol use disorder, you know, what is the likelihood basically of the other, and is that more than the general public? Is it more than is statistically significant? And probably from those studies, it's thought that alcohol use disorder probably has like a 50% genetic component. Family history puts you at risk. So if you have family members that have struggled with alcohol use disorder, that puts us at risk.
Why is that, do you think?
I think that there's two things. Probably one is a genetic component, you know, just a part of our genetic makeup. The other is you know, seeing alcohol as a child, being around, even culturally, people drinking, especially people drinking more heavily. And then also ACEs, so adverse childhood experiences. These are like well documented to have really result and put us at risk, I should say, for development of substance use disorders and other actually psychiatric issues.
Do you ever think it swings the other way in that maybe if you were raised in like a extremely restrictive or just sober household that you never got experience with it or normalized it or felt like you could ever ask for help if you didn't get any of that? As an adult, sometimes I've seen it. I went to a very religious private high school and college, and so sometimes you saw kids that would get into college and then all of a sudden they had that freedom and then mm-hmm. things completely swing the opposite way. Is that part of it too? Or is
yeah, it- certainly. I think that that could be an issue if you grew up in an environment where you're very ignorant to alcohol, mm-hmm. let's just say, and you don't really know like what it is. And especially as you enter maybe probably a lot of people's first interaction with alcohol is in college. You may be like underprepared to actually deal with that if you haven't like talked about it. I also have, you know, met patients and people close to me who have a family history of alcohol use disorder, and it ends up being protective where they are like, oh, I saw what this did to my dad. I saw this, what did to my mom, you know, and I don't drink. I'm yeah. like, and I feel like that's almost the opposite where they have like a really deep understanding of the consequences. Yeah.
That's me with smoking. My dad smoked forever, had a heart attack, continues to smoke. He's alive. I don't know. I'm using past tense. So yeah, for me, that was always just like a non-starter. Nothing mm-hmm. I was ever interested in. So yeah, I guess it has the potential to kind of be on either end of the spectrum. You can be completely adverse to it and not have an issue, or it can be, you know, a larger factor in your life, depending.
And yeah. And then other things that put us at risk are drinking in adolescence. And then there have been several studies that have shown that sexual minorities, really sexual and gender minorities, are more at risk for the development of alcohol mm-hmm. use disorder. Sexual minority women are more likely than their heterosexual counterparts to develop problematic drinking. Interestingly, people who identify as gay men have similar risk and rates of alcohol use disorder as their heterosexual counterparts. And then people with mental health disorders, especially anxiety, depression, PTSD, or sleep disorders, those people are at risk for also developing a problem with alcohol.
That's some of those stats are really interesting to me in terms of how sexual and gender minorities compare to their, you know, cis straight counterparts. Because the stereotype is that if you go into a gay bar and order a drink, like most people think it's very strong. And mm-hmm. for like in gay men, we were talking before I started, I live in Boys Town, very much go out, or North Halsted, go out there a lot. And so that's kind of the frame of reference I use for this. But, and so people that go to bars like Sidetrack and Roscoe's pretty often, you know, oh, that's normal. We don't think about it. But it's interesting that like in reality, the likelihood for developing substance alcohol use disorder is as high as it would be for, you know, a cis straight man
or
a cis gay man.
Yeah, I found, that is, I agree, that's really interesting. I think also like, you know, you and I are biased. We both live in North Halsted, but so, you know, we're going to these like mm-hmm. the bars that we usually go to and we're like, oh, wow, look at all these like, you know, people drinking and all, mm-hmm. you know, especially like guys drinking. But, you know, if you go to Wrigleyville, there's like an enormous,
listen,
like if you go there, yeah. you're going to be like, okay, it's the same.
Yeah. All you have to do is go two blocks like northwest yeah. and it's you immediately it's clear. yeah. How equal it is, at least as far as cis men are concerned. Why do you think sexual minority women are more predisposed to it versus mm-hmm. Non-sexual minority women? Because that's also interesting. I couldn't think of a justification for it.
I have no idea. I don't even like want to speculate because I really don't know. I was just reading SAMHSA, which is a federal agency that does a very large survey of the American public. And there's a focus on use disorders. I was reading like their data in their most recent publication. And yeah, it was really interesting, like for alcohol use disorder, bisexual women had really amongst almost any group, the highest rate amongst women for the development of alcohol use disorder. And I found that really interesting. And I thought a lot about that. I was like, I wonder why this is. And I really have no idea. We'd have to ask a sociologist.
You said bisexual women?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I could talk about the social dynamics all day, but the actual health effects on your body as a result of alcohol. Now, growing up, you get all of the health class talks about, you know, just one cigarette can shorten your life and all of the, sure. the scare statistics involved with it. Is that, as it relates to alcohol, true? What can you do to help take care of your body for somebody that's going to be drinking? What are some really negative outcomes of alcohol use disorder? How does that all shake out?
Yeah, so alcohol, as I kind of said earlier, an unfortunate truth, and it's just a fact that I think about all the time, especially when I'm drinking. I think this is a poison. there's a lot of confusion, and I do see quite a bit of like misinformation sometimes when I read about alcohol, in terms of like I hear constantly that a little bit amount of alcohol is good for you. It's like good for your cardiovascular health, and you know, at some point there may have been some even data that had possibly shown that. I think with more research that's come out even more recently, we probably are coming to the conclusion that alcohol is really not actually that safe in really any amount, and its toxic effects can be present even in people who are not drinking very much. Certainly the more you drink, the more at risk you're going to be for developing various physiologic consequences. I also always hear almost always from people here in the States, because I have family in Italy as well. And here people are like, in France and in Italy, people drink and they're really healthy and they live, forever. And, first of all, in Italy, even when I've gone there, I do see people with alcohol use disorder, certainly. And that exists there too. And my grandma, she's, in her 90s. She lives in a very rural part of Italy, very rural, and she drinks wine every day with her dinner. Mm-hmm. And what she does is she has this, it's a boxed wine, and she pours a tiny bit, must be a few ounces, it's almost like a shot or two's worth, into a glass, and fills the rest with water, and that's what she drinks with her dinner. She's done that for decades. So I have literally never seen someone drink like that in the US, even when people are like, I'm drinking wine with my dinner. We're drinking like much larger volumes. So,
I mean, Americans like to do things to excess.
That's one thing that I think is not helpful, to be like, in these other countries and other places, people are, their drinking patterns are completely different.
There's also I would guess a lot of other factors that go into maybe remediating some of the negative effects alcohol might have that exist in other countries that maybe say have better healthcare, have better behavioral health resources, have higher quality of food that they're intaking alongside of that. So maybe the negative consequences aren't as apparent.
That's a great point. I didn't really think about that, but that's totally something there. So the negative health consequences from alcohol can be pretty severe. So alcohol has toxic effects on our gastrointestinal tract. So certainly the liver is probably like the most famous thing. It can cause acute liver inflammation called hepatitis, or over long periods of time cause kind of fibrosis and scarring of the liver called cirrhosis, and ultimately liver failure. We can also have like stomach inflammation called gastritis. Alcohol also affects our cardiovascular system. It can contribute to high blood pressure. It has effect on our blood. So alcohol can actually have directly toxic effects to the bone marrow and can result in anemia, basically. And then also on our mental and psychiatric health, right? So definitely alcohol use disrupts sleep and can really destabilize mood, the people's mood and mood disorders, and exacerbate an underlying mental illness. So those are some of the things. I mean, alcohol is like, it's pretty powerful. It affects like almost every part of our body, really. So it's just another really depressing fact.
No, it's really interesting because I've been sober all of November, and not for any like particular reason. One, alcohol is super expensive. So I was like, I'm just going to be extra budget friendly. But it's interesting to think about the symptoms and kind of what it's doing to your body, especially as I've been, you know, absent it for a month. Because I think definitely the sleep and the mood is a huge thing I've noticed even in the month, because for me, I've never been a good sleeper. It's, you know, I always melatonin or something, or I have to be really, you know, fastidious about my sleep routine in order to sleep soundly. And so on weekends, you know, drinking will knock you out, but the quality of sleep isn't good. And then the, you know, the next day, the hangover anxiety, so to speak, is huge. Yeah. And so I've definitely found eliminating alcohol to be beneficial as far as those are concerned. I obviously can't know what my liver looks like or how anything's going inside of me, but the you know, outward markers, I feel like, are definitely noticeable. But it's, and again, this goes back to like the first half of the show where we're talking about the cultural and societal stuff. But the, you know, going out with friends and still choosing to be sober is a lot harder than, not necessarily because I felt like I needed that drink to have fun, but more just, I felt I was so othered because I wasn't. Like it was my boyfriend's birthday and, wanted to go to a drag brunch. Lovely. The non-alcoholic option, as compared to the bottomless mimosas was only $10 less. And so it's like, well, I'm still paying the same amount, but I'm, you know, don't get the person squirting champagne into my mouth. That looks fun. Like I'm going to, I don't know. There's all the stuff that goes along with it. And suddenly I get why people want, you know, a non-alcoholic wine just so they can have something in their hand, you know, in a setting like that. That's a tangent. And I'm not on my list of questions right now talking about that, but yeah, it's really fascinating to think about, the side effects and how quickly they go away and how much better you might feel after you know, stop a pattern of drinking alcohol on any level, honestly.
Yeah. I always get soda water and lime if I'm not drinking so that it looks like a drink and no one will bother.
See, I was having Red Bull the other weekend and then I was like, oh, but that's bad because there's such little cans. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I've had two, and that's a lot of caffeine late at night and sugar. So that's, yeah, I'm going to have to cut that one out as well. But, so the interesting thing about the symptoms for me as well is, you know, as you exit college or you know, drink to a high level socially, there's all of those, I feel like wives' tales is an outdated phrase, but there's all of those notions that, you know, beer before liquor or liquor before beer, if you're mixing or, you know, if you have cranberry juice, it's actually not as bad or all of those things that people kind of try to use to help or to justify. Are any of those true, or are we just kidding ourselves to make ourselves feel better?
I think, you know, I really wish I could tell you those things are true. I really do. I think that there is no data, to my knowledge, no robust data, at least,
to justify any of them.
To justify any of those things. So, but I think what can be done, like for patients or people who are trying to like pull back on their drinking, and they're like, I don't want to stop completely, but I want to pull back. You know, I recommend like alternating between alcohol and non-alcoholic beverages, especially starting with a non-alcoholic beverage to maintain hydration, and then eating also before drinking can be helpful. Counting your drinks is very helpful. There's like a bunch of apps actually that can help people like that. There's apps that can help you essentially count your drinks, and then it starts like flashing at you or kind of warning you like, hey, like you're getting to a place that you don't want to be. So I think that those are some helpful you know, strategies.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the hardest part is like, those are all good in theory and good to think about when you're sober. But like, sometimes you get, you know, three drinks in and having a glass of water between drinks becomes, is not your top priority.
Becomes less
dancing
exciting.
To that song is your top priority. And, you know, I'm not going to pull out an app to update the number of drinks I've had. I'm just going to have another drink.
Yeah.
And then I'll look back at my credit card statement in the morning and remind myself. And so for me, that was the hardest part about drinking is the, you know, once you start, it is very difficult, or at least for me, it was difficult to maintain a grasp on what is, you know, just right. What is too much? Where do we stop? How do we level that all out? Because, it felt a little bit all or nothing, which I know as I wrote down the like loss of control is one of those criteria yeah. where it's like, yeah, how do you have a clear head when it comes to that decision making in the midst of using a substance like alcohol that causes you not to have a clear head? Like,
yeah, it results, you know, alcohol is like definitely changes the way we make decisions
right.
and can result in impulsivity, which like, you know, puts us at risk for tons of things, not just drinking more, but also, you know, being less careful when we're making other decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Probably what I see the most, Howard Brown, or what most patients are struggling with is like, decisions around sex and safety around sex, you know,
yeah.
well, after you've been drinking.
So. Yeah, we have a whole episode on chemsex, and that was one of the questions.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, is alcohol technically chemsex? Because it's mm-hmm. not, they don't label alcohol as a drug, but it does affect your, you know, ability to process consent okay. and all of that stuff. That is fascinating because it's a question. This is also a tangent, but it's a question a lot of my friends have had, my single friends, and not single friends, who, you know, go out drinking, go home with somebody, and they're like, well, I wasn't not consenting, but had I been sober, I probably wouldn't have.
Yeah.
So it's like, then, you know, where does that fall? Is that,
yeah.
you know, it's hard to reckon with as somebody in that situation, you know, in the aftermath, like you weren't sexually assaulted, but you didn't probably want to do that thing. So it's the question of what level of responsibility is there for the actions that you take while drunk? I don't know. That's more of a like probably behavioral health question and episode unto itself. But.
Yeah, that's a really hard thing to navigate, I think. But I mean, I think what it does underscore, what you're really underscoring is that, you know, alcohol... We including me, including myself, you know, we try to be
mm-hmm.
maybe flippant about it or like kind of minimize alcohol and its effects. But really, the moment you really dig into this and you start to uncover, you know, alcohol, its effects on the body, its effects on our behavior, its effects on our health, physical and mental, it's...
Yeah,
it becomes more and more grim.
Yeah. Like, I know what you mean about, like, trivializing it. I have a reaction photos like meme album on my phone
mm-hmm.
of like funny things to send in chats. And I, now that I think about it, probably a good portion of them are related to like, oh, I'm hungover, or like, oh, like I, you
yeah.
know, was, you know, out and about last night, that kind of thing. So it's like, it really, is culturally so, easy to talk about and also hard to talk about. Which I think is really fascinating for a lot of healthcare topics, like we were talking about before we hit record, is that like the challenge with talking about healthcare is that a lot of it's so private, a lot of it is very personal, and just not something society talks about. But alcohol is so everywhere.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's and the
a huge business.
Posters are everywhere. There's you know, commercials. You know, there's like billboards all over the place for, you know. Liquor. I always imagine like how difficult it would be for people in recovery if you lived in North Halsted. Like it would just be really difficult. I talk to my patients a lot about that, and it's a big challenge.
Yeah,
sure.
And like I also know for people that feel like they have to be quote unquote doing something in order to, you know, be out at a bar or out at a club
mm-hmm.
or whatever. I know people that have, you know, switched to, you know, having a gummy before they go out, and then they'll or like a CBD soda, or there are more extreme options like G, or you know, some nose drugs or things that people prefer. In your estimation, are people that kind of do that pivot from alcohol to something else, something that probably has less long-term, maybe less long-term effects, is that a justifiable option, or is that just kind of trading one harmful substance for another? Like,
yeah, I think
I would have to say, to be like just, you know, honest and frank, that is not a great idea in the sense that, you know, other substances, especially something like GHB, can be, you know, extremely dangerous, and especially mixing, you know, alcohol with other substances. GHB has a similar mechanism to alcohol, interestingly. So that with alcohol is an especially dangerous mixture. And the problem is with a lot of these substances is it alters our decision-making capacity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're intoxicated, especially with another substance, and you go to a bar and people are drinking, you can imagine how quickly you could find yourself in a situation where you're drinking on top of. So now there's like a multiple substance mixture.
And oh yeah. Like
now we're in a whole different.
No, I've seen that where somebody says that they're not drinking, they're, you know, dosing, and then all of a sudden they have a White Claw in their hand, and it's like, that's not what you said.
Yeah, it's hard. I know I know that we really want these. I know, and I really want these things.
Right, like you wish there was an alternative. It's not. Why have we not invented, you know, consequence-free alcohol? Whoever patents that is, right? Whoever patents that is a millionaire. We're close on time, so we're going to do some rapid-fire questions. In terms of medical treatments for the dependence on alcohol, what... I know of roughly some medications, or rather what those medications do, but what options exist for people that are wanting to like medically treat their dependence on alcohol aside from just behavioral changes?
Yeah. So alcohol use disorder is very, very well studied. And there are a lot of very effective treatment options. So first I want to say, like, anyone who thinks that they might be struggling with alcohol, you know, just to know that there's definitely help out there, and the treatments for alcohol use disorder are very effective. And most people who want to stop drinking can, and most people who want to reduce drinking can do that too. For alcohol use disorder, there's probably like the most comprehensive way to treat it would be through three different mechanisms. One would be pharmacotherapy, so medications. There's three FDA approved medications for the treatment of alcohol use disorder. There's also others that are off label. So medications would be one. The second would be behavioral health, so psychotherapy. So that would be like either individual psychotherapy with a therapist, or IOP, which is intensive outpatient programs, or partial hospitalization programs. These are all different programs that work with people who are struggling.
Is
with
that rehab, in other words?
And then residential the other one, which is, you know, also called rehab, and residential programs are where you stay there.
Gotcha.
So partial hospital or IOP programs are programs where you go for several hours multiple times a week. So it's almost like going to school, but you're, you know, meeting with counselors, you're in groups, you're doing like, you know, various projects basically to help you kind of enter recovery. And then, medication, psychotherapy, and then peer support. So peer support are groups, right, with peers, people in recovery. Probably the most, like, famous is AA.
Mm-hmm.
And I always hear a lot of rhetoric around AA that I don't like. You know, a lot of people, there's a lot of, like, hand-waving and arm-wringing about AA.
Mm-hmm.
It can be extremely effective and has been for millions of people. There's also other peer support groups. So there's like Smart Recovery, there's Refuge Recovery. And then there's like apps again, there's more apps where there's like recovery communities. Yeah. So there's apps where you can talk to people and message with people who are also trying to remain alcohol free or reduce their use. And even you can even be linked with people who are in the same amount of days of sobriety as you. You know, so you could be like, oh, we're on day 10 and, you know, I'm kind of struggling with this, you know, and then you have like a quick turnaround. Somebody who
very clearly gets it. I love that concept because that's something I've noticed in like a completely separate area, like personal fitness, going to the gym. I found the only thing that motivates me is having like a personal trainer that's there waiting for me to, you know, to show up and to do the work, or somebody that's going with me that like we're doing this together. That like social aspect is very motivating. So I can see why it would be useful in sobriety too, where you have a partner that's on the same road as you and you're doing it. I mean, in some cases, probably as much for them, depending on the relationship, for somebody else as you are for yourself. So that's fascinating.
I also want to say that recovery isn't always just sobriety. So I see a lot of patients at Howard Brown who just want to reduce their drinking. So they might have an alcohol use disorder even. They may even meet diagnostic criteria, but they're like, I'm not really ready to completely stop, but I want to reduce my drinking. Yeah. And there are medications, and even in psychotherapy, there are methods to help people reduce the amount of that they're drinking that are very effective. So
two final questions. In terms of the medications you mentioned, how do they function specifically? Because I feel like I've heard of ones that like make your body react more strongly to alcohol so that you like have a intense negative reaction, or is it more like psychological where it alters more like an antidepressant kind of?
Yeah. So the medication you're referring to that makes you sick when you drink is called disulfiram, what is also called Antabuse. That is an older medication. I think it's from the 50s or 60s. Oh, wow. But it still can be used, and I have used it in patients. That's primarily used in patients that want to be completely alcohol free and want to take a pill that they take in the morning that basically forces them not to drink, because they know if they drink, they will get sick. Mm. They get physically ill. Probably the most commonly used medication actually is naltrexone. Naltrexone is an anti-opioid medication. It's an opioid antagonist. You may be wondering, like, why would you give an opioid antagonist, an anti-opioid drug to a person struggling with alcohol use? And basically what this is aimed at doing is, you know, when we drink alcohol, it has kind of a dopaminergic effect, right? It gives you a rush of dopamine. It makes you kind of feel good. A lot of drugs are like this. You get basically a type of euphoria, which is separate from intoxication, but you actually get like a euphoria, like a feel good feeling. That triggers a whole cascade in the brain of like different circuits. And one of the big ones is a rewards circuit. And the rewards circuit in the brain is some of the major neurotransmitters in that circuit are endogenous opioids. So opioids that your body naturally produces. So you drink alcohol, you have a good feel good feeling, you get an endorphins release. And that kind of causes a positive feedback loop, which can lead to a pathologic process, basically an addiction or a use disorder. Naltrexone basically aims at interrupting that process. So you can still even drink while taking naltrexone. And basically what it will do is you'll still get intoxicated. You know, it's still not safe to drink and drive, et cetera. It will not block intoxication. It will not make you sick. But what it does is it prevents that. It interrupts that whole cascade of dopamine to then endorphins reward system. And so it basically helps decouple that from alcohol so that the person over time starts to drink.
The psychological reward of drinking is lessened. That's really fascinating. Because I know from our episodes on ADHD that like the dopamine, fueling practices, people with ADHD especially seek those out. So the comorbidity still the correct term, even though it's like...
Yeah, I would...
Because morbidity makes me think of death, but it's not like, you know...
Or it also could just be...
related,
Illness.
Right, the overlap between... co-occurring, I like that. The overlap between, ADHD and alcohol use disorder, I think is really interesting. Because for me, it would always be... And this is a tangent and a really eye-opening realization for me is that when I would be drinking, I have ADHD, I take Adderall. in the morning, but when you're drinking into the wee hours of the night, your Adderall has worn off, so that there's nothing there regulating that dopamine seeking behavior. So I always found that, like, all of a sudden out of nowhere, I'd be extra drunk, or I'd be acting very differently when my, you know, if I had that same amount in the middle of the day at like a brunch or something, it wouldn't be the same effect.
Interesting. Yeah.
So maybe that's just me hypothesizing or trying to rationalize poor decisions I made while drunk. But I think that's really interesting how it might factor in with other behavioral health conditions like ADHD. But again, we're close on time. So one last question. what advice would you offer to, I mean, I guess anyone, but I think it's interesting. What advice would you offer to friends or family of somebody who might be struggling with this? Mm-hmm. If you're concerned about somebody, or if you're concerned for yourself, how do you, what language tips do you have, or, you know, advice do you have for somebody that wants to normalize, that wants to talk about it or get help or offer help to somebody?
Yeah.
Because sometimes, like we said, talking about alcohol is so easy unless you're talking about having a problem with alcohol. Yeah. And then it's so hard. So how do you have that conversation, whether it's with yourself or with another person?
I think if someone is struggling with alcohol use, like, or really is, or any substance use, I think the first thing that you should consider is talking to your doctor. Mm-hmm. I know I'm very biased about this, but, you know, especially your family doctor, or your psychiatrist, if you have a psychiatrist, about this and about, and even, they may even be able to just help you dive into that conversation of, like, is this a problem? We do have screening tools to help us, and also diagnostic criteria to help us figure out, is this a problem or is this not? How safe is this? How safe is, you know, what's happening in your life? SAMHSA, the federal agency, has a hotline you can also call if you're struggling with substance use or alcohol and you need help and stabilization more quickly. Or yeah, as I said, kind of speaking with your physician, if you have a therapist, trying to, or seeking out a therapist to talk to, you know, that can be very helpful. If you have a family member who is, you perceive as struggling with alcohol or any substance use, and they, I do get this question, I think, fairly often, and they're, mm-hmm. they're really not there, like, to discuss it. I think it can be aggravating to, you know, be too aggressive and pushy. If you go to them, you say, you have a problem with alcohol and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's important to set your boundaries, especially with a family member, if their use of substances is starting to harm you, and really making that boundary clear and verbalizing it. But also kind of gently talking with a person and helping them dig into it, you know, like, what do you think about your drinking? How do you feel like it's helping you? Mm. How do you feel like it's harming you? These are really conversations that are, like, best done by a psychotherapist. So also encouraging people to, you know, talk to their doctor, talk to their therapist.
Right.
You know, it's hard for me to give advice to family members if you have no training, you know, like, you right. could find yourself in a really difficult conversation yeah. that you're not equipped to have, you right. know. This took me years of training to mm-hmm. like get down. So
you're a professional still, in this for a reason. Yeah, you definitely.
So yeah, I think that can be really hard, but there is also, you know, ways to navigate people who we call as being pre-contemplation. So they're really not at all kind of aware or accepting that they might have a problem. Therapists, you know, do have training in that population as well. Mm-hmm. So therapists are gentle, typically. I can't speak for all of them. My partner's a therapist, so I'm, like, very biased towards them. But, you know, they typically and hopefully have, you know, a gentle kind of conversation with someone. Yeah. And sometimes it takes time. Sometimes for me in clinic, it's about planting the seed. Mm-hmm. I have been in countless scenarios where I talk to a patient. They have high risk drinking, but they don't meet any alcohol use criteria. So I'm like, you know, you're drinking kind of heavily. I can see maybe you have some liver inflammation. You should really try to cut back. And then I see them later and they're like, I tried cutting back and I wasn't able to. And now a use disorder has emerged, you know, right. but it was like a slow process to get there.
Yeah.
If I had on day one, I'd been like, you need to stop. You know, like,
yeah, it's probably one of those things where somebody has to come to the realization, or at least have the seed planted, and then, you know, think about it themselves.
Yeah.
Because you can't force somebody to come to those conclusions about their own behavior. Mm-hmm. Like they have to think about themselves. Yeah. I ask only because I see that so often, especially in the communities that I'm a part of, where like, at what point is it like, you know, roll your eyes and, oh, you, when somebody, you know, lists the bad decisions they made while drinking, or is it, you know, and then when does that cross the line into, I think you should seek help. Yeah. It's a hard line as a friend to know when they're fine, or there's something more there. But like you said, ultimately it's just about planting the seed and being there for them in as many other ways as possible, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. Being, you know, gentle and kind with people, I think is like probably the best route. And to be like, hey, you could also just be more frank. Say, you know, I'm worried about you. I'm worried about your drinking. Yeah. Have you thought of talking to your doctor about this? You know?
Yeah. All valid options. Well, I could talk about this forever. We're already at an hour, believe it or not. Any final parting thoughts, things that I didn't bring up that you want to make sure people learn about?
We do, you know, have a pretty robust network of primary care at Howard Brown, obviously. So, you know, if patients feel like they're struggling with alcohol use, they, you know, should talk to their doctor or, you know, provider about it, including at Howard Brown. I've had other providers at Howard Brown reach out to me for their patients. You know, Howard Brown is like an extremely collaborative environment amongst the providers. So I've had other providers reach out to me. Hey, this might be going on. What should we do? You know, we've called hospitals for our patients that have been hospitalized to help us in terms of substance use disorders to see what can be done. We've referred people to medically managed withdrawal, also known as detox, from Howard Brown. So like, it's something that can be tackled in clinic. So, and then not for alcohol use, but for opiate use disorders, we do actually have a program at Howard Brown, which includes peer support, which is amazing. Hopefully one day we can like expand this. I want to really expand it to methamphetamine use and alcohol use, but we'll see.
It's a whole other podcast.
But so yeah, I think my parting words would be if you're struggling with alcohol use, there are very effective treatments for alcohol use disorder that can really help you. And there is a life in recovery. I think a lot of people, their block is that like, well, I can't imagine what my life would be. I think we may even have in our talk exacerbated this, right? Because we're like,
right. I brought up how hard it is.
How would we do at the bar and the drag show and stuff like that. But like there is a very rich life for people in recovery. My patients who are in long-term remission of alcohol use or other substance use tell me that they kind of like you with your sober month, like they feel better than they ever have, and that they're happier and they're having more fun than they've ever had.
Yeah.
So recovery is totally possible. And if you feel like you need it, just talk to your doctor about it.
Yeah. Those are great thoughts. And I completely agree. I think if you're somebody that's maybe embarked on the process of being sober or reducing your alcohol consumption, I think talking about it is huge. I know for me, before I went into a sober month, I saw a lot of friends or I guess just people I knew from Twitter talking about, as it is in the gay community, talking about making the switch to being sober and how, you know, helpful and freeing it's been for them. And so that planted the seed for me. So I think being open about, you know, what you're trying to do, even if you're not successful with it, like I think telling people that you're going to try for a sober month, and even if you only make it halfway for whatever reason, I think just talking about it on any level, regardless of you know, how serious you're taking it, I think is important to normalize that conversation. But we'll cap it there. Thank you so much for your time, Francesco. I joke with every guest that we'll have to have you back for a part two. And that's not ever a joke. It's always actually sincere, because everybody I've talked to on every topic, there's so much more to dive into and so much more nuance, as is the case with alcohol use disorder. I always kind of try to make the disclaimer that like, there's only so much to cover in an hour. So for people listening, if you're like, well, wait, what about this angle? What about this identity or this factor that is important, you're probably absolutely right. But as two people chatting for limited amounts of time, we can only cover so much. But all that to say, thank you so much. I can't wait to edit this and post it everywhere. So I appreciate it. Have a good one.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that has been our episode about alcohol use disorder with Dr. Francesco Tani. If you are interested in any of the resources that he mentioned at the end of this episode, I'm going to put it in the episode description down below. You can go ahead and peruse those. Thank you so much for listening.